come, that at the proper moment a new king would arise after the Armageddon, and the world should be ruled by a divine power, that all of the selfishness of things will pass away. One of the prophecies of the Sibyls was that gold and silver shall lose their guile. All the things that have tempted man away from his own integrities will of themselves cease, because they are only there because men support them, because they believe in them, and because they want to perpetuate them. Now the question always arises in minds of a great many people as to how we can live if we didn't have all this pressure. If we would settle down to the quiet ways of life, could we survive? Is it possible under the present situation to take care of the perpetuation of the species without this endless conflict and this endless disparity of opportunity? Well, there's a question there, and maybe it's a question that must be faced someday. But there is a point which we can face, a degree of it, in which we can come to the certainty that the essentials of life are available if we know how to use them, and if we use them without exploitation. This tremendous overculture, this overpowering economic structure, is not justified by nature. It is not part of an original plan for things. It has been built up like the patches on the coat of many colors, simply because every mistake led to some kind of a new legislation, and this in turn led to others to ultimate confusion. The problem of why are we here must finally come into focus. Are we here simply to keep on grubbing along until we use up everything we have? Are we here until it becomes necessary for us to try to fly off to some other planet which may or may not be inhabitable? Is it necessary for us to keep on polluting the atmosphere, polluting the water, in destroying endangered species until nothing is left? This is a rather dismal prospect, but a lot of people are acting as though this was the inevitable end and that there's no way of avoiding it. There are many ways of avoiding it. One of the ways to avoid it is to begin to examine ourselves in another and more critical sense of the word. What have we got inside of ourselves which is more important than what we are trying to do outside of ourselves? Those who have given much thought and study and meditation to this problem realize that the great unexplored territory at the present time is the inner life of man himself. We have no understanding whatever of the potential of the human being. We are quite convinced that he is a very animated and sapient biped who wanders about making trouble for himself and other people. We are convinced that if he adds up $1 billion, that he has fulfilled his own potential, even though he loses it the next day. But we have never really explored the human being to find out what he is good for. We do not know what raw material is locked within him. We are doing everything we can to change the world, but giving very little thought to the unfoldment of the natural resources of man himself. What would he have to do or be in order to be happy? What would be necessary in order for him to be safe for himself and others? What is the end that would more than justify the sacrifice of a lot of castles in sand piles? What would be in man that would be worth more to him, to everyone else, and to his own happiness and security than $10 million in the bank? Well, man is a potential masterpiece. But for one reason or another, he has deformed the sculpturing himself. He is no longer giving attention to the possibilities of his own nature. The solution to his problems are not necessarily in the pushing of his present procedures beyond a reasonable limit. What would we feel, how would we feel, if, for instance, in a little period, few thousand years at most, maybe less, we began to develop the extrasensory band within the human being? Supposing in the course of time, we reach a point in which, inwardly, we have sensory perceptions that would enable us to judge and estimate practically everything in nature. How would it be if, for instance, we came to a point where there could be, in this world, no such a thing as a secret? Supposing that we can read everybody's mind. And, of course, everyone is reading ours at the same time. Supposing there'd be no need for concealment and no possibility of it. Well, in our present situation, this would practically result in universal bankruptcy. We can't trust ourselves, and we have greater distrust of others. Supposing our politicians could never hide anything from us. Supposing our lawyers couldn't. And supposing we had an understanding of our own lives and our own bodies to the positions, to the degree that a physician could not make a mistake. And supposing all of this costs nothing, because we are born with it. All right, suppose in the same length of time, we, and under the same conditions, we reorganize our theory of nutrition. Perhaps our nutritional theory isn't just exactly right. Perhaps the greater part of our nutrition should not come from the earth, but from light, from the power of energies in space. Supposing the individual could survive indefinitely by developing the abilities of his own magnetic field. Supposing he could travel by teleportation. Perhaps every faculty and power that has been fictionally used in magic is natural and possible to him, with a complete regeneration of his motivations. Perhaps then he could realize that the moment he is selfish, this entire world of beauty begins to collapse around him. While he is unselfish, it is there. Freed from a great many things, he doesn't have to be lazy. Today, if we get a little money or something of that nature, we sit down in front of a television set and spend the rest of our time wasting it. Supposing instead of that, this new perspective on things gave us an entirely different orientation to what life was about. That we have countless ways of gaining greater insights, exploring, discovering, enjoying, recognizing the common friendships and kinships of life, and that in a gentle and friendly way we could live with each other. Perhaps under a few of those circumstances we might observe that the need for constant policing and countless legislative protection might greatly diminish. We wouldn't need it. The individual would not need the protection that is necessary because he is not honorable in his relationships. Albert Hubbard years ago made a rather interesting statement on business. He said, every individual is now receiving a salary five times what it seems to be. If he is getting $50 a week, which was a big money in those days, it is because he is entitled to $500, and his real salary is $500. But he has to deduct that from that, the $450 that other people have to spend to take care of him and make sure he knows what he's doing. Supposing we had these skills and abilities. Suppose also we had a new religious concept that we realize fully and clearly from inward experience, the inward source of all faith, that we beheld more or less the heavens opening and the divine plan unfolding before us. That no longer we had to believe in anything, we knew.
We also would learn to know in that time how to protect life, how to prolong it. We would learn how to normalize populations. We would know how to combat aging processes. We would also realize that without perversion and corruption, the resources of the earth would survive and carry a much greater population than we have today. It is selfishness that is destroying the power of the earth to provide us with what we need. So if this new time came, in which we did things right, where we had time for music and art, where we had time for friendship, and time to unfold the tremendous creativities within ourselves, that in each one of us is the artist, each of us can be the mathematician to explore the universe, each one of us can be the psychology to investigate the inner structure of our own souls. With these possibilities, a great part of the corruptions of life would be overcome. And we could possibly move into a new way of life, a new heaven and a new earth, a universal reformation in which out of the sorrow, sickness, and weariness of our own mistakes, we are beginning to see the end that we should know and understand and work with every day. Now we are also concerned, as this Armageddon problem grows stronger in our minds, we are more and more concerned with finding ways to pinpoint it. That actually each person must realize that the Armageddon in his own life is more or less the result of opposite forces locked in conflict. There is an old saying that the prophet, when he would do good, evil was ever nigh unto him. And this is the problem with the individual. He is constantly torn between his charities and his selfishness. He is constantly torn between serving others and protecting self-interest. His ambitions lure him away, not only from the natural joys of life, but also undermine his health and surround him with ambitious followings who are ready to destroy him any minute for their own gain. How are we going to meet this problem that is in our lives every day? That hardly a day goes by when we pick up a telephone or anything else, when there isn't a little conflict of some kind introduced into our way of life. If we are therefore allowed to sit down for a moment, we estimate our problem, and then we're likely to say to ourselves, well, I'll do the best I can, which means we will do what is most profitable at the moment. Principles are ignored. We just do not have the courage to challenge security. We are afraid that we will destroy some advantage of our own. We do not want to risk our job. We do not wish to alienate our friends. We do not wish to damage our reputations through integrities in an environment where they do not exist. Yet with all this type of thing, this fear, we are punishing ourselves every day. And we can always go back to some very simple rules and principles that we can use without necessarily annoying anyone else. In fact, the average individual under the present condition of his life is one of the greatest annoyers that has ever been created. We can annoy everyone, including ourselves. But supposing instead of trying to do this, we begin to see if we can't fight out these little Armageddons each day, that we will put the strength of our integrity against the pressure of corrupted circumstances, that we will begin by disciplining ourselves to the degree that we can put off or deny some of the pressure temptations that arise within our own minds. If we can say to ourselves occasionally, I think it would be best if I do this, but I must give up that, that perhaps there are times when we should give up that. We do not have to form these policies that are unchangeable in their corruption. A man was talking, a psychiatrist was talking to a patient and said to this particular patient, "You should try to be more patient with your family." And the man just looked him straight in the eye and said, "I can't do it. It's impossible." Well, to most people, anything that interferes with habit is virtually impossible. They cannot go against the patterns that they have built up. Disposition takes over. The ancient policies reaffirm themselves, and we are subject not only to the ancient policies of our own generation, but of other generations that have preceded us. We simply are unable to do that which we do not want to do. We can think of 1,000 excuses. And when it comes to a head-on collision, we just set the jaw and do that which we intended to do, whether it is right or wrong. Now, this is something we can begin to overcome. Because when we take this attitude, we then become the kings of the world, and we are declaring war on the hierarchies of heaven. In a small way, we declare war on truth every time we choose to do wrong. Now, it doesn't look like it amounts to much. Who cares whether we make this little mistake or that little mistake? But in the long run, this mistake and that mistake all combine to make a great mistake, and that is ourselves. We are not able to control ourselves. Our habits have taken over. World habits have taken over. The corruptions of 50 generations are dominating the present generation. And the mistakes of 50 or 60 years of personal living dominate millions of people today. They cannot change. They cannot get over their intolerances, their bigotries, their inconsistencies. And of course, every negative attitude is a health destroyer. It begins to corrupt circulation, it destroys the body, tears down the emotions, and afflicts the mind. Little by little, these small mistakes, these wrong attitudes, coming together, come to the final termination of bringing us down in a defeat. We have lost the Armageddon. The battle is lost, and there is nothing that then remains except for us to retire from the stage and maybe in a future embodiment do better. We are not gaining the results that we are entitled to. Now, it may well be that the average individual isn't strong enough to make a universal reformation of himself on any given day, but he can work on it. One way he can work on it is, if necessary, to write down a resolution. He can decide that something that he has always done that he knows isn't good for him, he's not going to do. Just one thing. If he has always been a procrastinator, he's going to do things on time from now on. If he has always been a little bit of a bigot, he is going to study the things he hates and see whether he's right or not. And chances are he'll find he was wrong. There's a little old story about this old preacher who believed astrology was the work of the devil. And he preached against it every Sunday from the pulpit, loud and clear. Finally, someone said to him, "You're saying the same thing all the time. If you're going to talk about this subject, why don't you get some new ammunition? If you don't like it, find out more why you don't like it." So he crept into a couple of meetings of astrologers in London back in the old days when they met near Gray's Inn. And he listened at the back. He was looking for more information with which to downgrade the subject. After 3 or 4 meetings, he went back and changed his mind and said it was a lot better than he thought it was. Now, it's the same way with most bigotries. The individual, the perfect bigot, is the individual who is supremely ignorant. And the only way to get over it is to find out and to get rid of prejudices and to get rid of all these antagonisms. You can make a separate statement of jealousies, or extravagance, or waste, or deceit, or something that you are having a little trouble with. Put it down and stay with it. See, every time that the opportunity comes along to express this particular negative attitude, read the note and stay with your resolution to do it better. In a short time, you can make a game out of this, which is rather more interesting and certainly more profitable than bridge. And as a result of gradually making a game of self-improvement, you also have all the advantages of a delightful form of solitaire. You do not need anyone else to help you enjoy this. You can do it yourself. But gradually, as you get out of these pressures, you will find that you will be better adjusted socially, that you will have more friends, that you will have less worry, less confusion, and life will be far more pleasant and meaningful to you. But the problem is to get over that hurdle, to be able to break up this vicious determination to keep on doing it the same way, and being unable to take a chance. Always the fear that some way or other we will lose more by changing. But in the majority of cases, we're losing everything by not changing. There's also a great deal of help to be gained from moderate philosophical studies in these fields. If we really understand the great teachings of the past, or some of the better teachings of the present, we will find a great deal of ground for insights into the various problems that beset us. If we know that we have a major problem, we can take it up in terms of one of the philosophical systems that have worked with that problem. There is really no problem that can arise in human nature which has not been at some time pretty thoroughly ventilated. Long ago, maybe thousands of years ago, the answer to your problem was formulated, and it was a good answer. But the average person today has never even heard of the answer. So that it requires a little study, a little research in your chosen field of personal redemption to find out what you really need and how to get about it, what the solution is, why it is necessary, and why common sense can support you in making the necessary changes. In this way, you will gradually recruit your army, your army of good thoughts, your army of intelligent decisions, your army of clarified principles. And these are the army of the light that can protect you against the powers of darkness. And when the times of decision come, they are your defenders of the faith, which is very, very important. Another aspect of the situation that we, I think, should go into a little bit, perhaps, is the problem of children in connection with the needs of the moment. Young people are usually reasonably honest. They have to be well disciplined in dishonesty to do a perfect job of it. They would like to do right, most of them. They would like to hope a good life, to bring and have their own families and raise them, and have useful work and do it. The most young people, especially children, are by nature intending to be honest. They've had no instruction to speak of in this problem of the building of character. For some reason, probably intentional, the development of integrity is not taught. It is something that we feel should not be taught because it would interfere with the individual's accumulation of worldly goods. I remember when here in Los Angeles we had on the Board of Education a very dynamic lady who was determined to do something about getting some integrity into the public school system. She realized that it wasn't possible to, you know, go religious or to teach creeds of something, but she suggested and recommended to the school board that it select, or have someone select for it, a series of brief quotations, one line or two lines at most, from all of the outstanding leaders of world thought, the great scholars, scientists, philosophers, religionists, everyone from all walks, a strong moral statement of an idealistic nature that would be read each morning by the teacher at the beginning of the school day. This was to be either written on the blackboard or simply spoken. And it was there be no definition involving a creedal selectivity. It might be one day from Einstein, it might be the next day from Victor Hugo, but it would be a statement of integrities, useful from a celebrated person. The woman had hardly got the idea out of her mouth before an adamant lady in the back seat got up. And she said, "I don't want anything like that to happen." She said, "If you do things like that and you teach my boy to be honest, he'll be a failure." This is the way the approach has been. We are afraid that ideals will damage our economic status. We believe that it is more important to keep the individual competitive, make him believe that he has got to cheat his way to the top, than it is for him to have the type of instruction that would make him a good citizen, a good husband, a good son, or a good father. These problems we are afraid of. So in these fears, we are also building up toward this final showdown, which has to come in every life. Now, this showdown does not mean the end of the world. This showdown does not mean the planet will slip out of orbit and disappear. It simply means that a way of life will fail. Many ways of life have failed already. There is an ancient Hindu statement that says, "The great mother, the earth, has shaken countless civilizations from her back." How many we do not even know. We have buried in the dust of time many cultures that at one time believed themselves to be indestructible. The Roman Empire did not believe that Rome could ever fall. Egypt could not imagine a time when the great monuments of Egypt would be in rotting dust or swallowed up by the desert. It was impossible that these glories would pass, but they all passed because they had not built into themselves the permanences of integrity. They passed because they did not deserve to live. And any civilization that breaks the rules must either correct its mistakes or join those that sleep in the dust. There is no possible way of corruption winning. There is no possible way of avoiding the final showdown in which the infirmities of a situation come face to face with the surviving power of that situation. And if the infirmities are too great and the surviving power is too weak, another civilization simply fades away. That doesn't mean that humanity ceases. It doesn't mean that there's a great failure. It simply means that a great lesson has been required, and that that lesson has been meted out. That there is no question whatever as to what the facts are. And then on these facts we can build. Nature has given to each one of us the power to change, the power to do those things which are necessary. It has given us the skills and the wisdom to develop better ways of life. And we have used too many of them to exploit each other. Thus we come finally to the Armageddon. We come finally in every walk of life to that time in which we must stand up and be counted. We are either going with the truth or against it. And there is no middle ground, no compromise possible. There is no procrastination that will solve anything. It is up to us to make within ourselves a whole series of little Armageddons in which we have fought out our own mistakes one by one and won the fight. Little by little, gaining control of the weaknesses and delinquencies of our own mental and emotional compositions, and finally facing into the problem of the world. And if enough of us have defeated ignorance in ourselves, if we have gained strength to stand with principles, if enough accomplish this, the Armageddon will be solved and the powers of light will be the winners. And if they are the winners, then there will be this new heaven and the new earth. which is based upon the virtues of enlightened human beings uniting to protect the society which they wish to preserve. There is no reason why we shouldn't live in a beautiful garden. There's no reason why the best land on earth should be given over to battlefields. These things represent not humanity, but the lack of it. They would come not because we are brighter and stronger and more intelligent and more resourceful, but because we are very foolish and selfish and self-centered and self-destroying. So it starts with us. We can do what we please about it. But if we do what is right, we become part of the army of light that is going to defend principles. If we compromise, we will be part of the army of darkness. And the battle of light and darkness, of truth and error, of wisdom and ignorance, of virtue and vice, this conflict goes on and on until, in the long run, regardless of anything we attempt to avoid, in the long run, each of us must win. But we make a terrible fight out of it. We have many miseries we do not need. We have many tragedies we could avoid. We have many disappointments that are unnecessary. And right now, I think it's very important to think about some of these things because of the condition of the world in which we live. We are beginning to see clearly that the old way of things that has given us nearly 8,000 wars is not going to give us peace. The only war that can end in peace is the war in which we fight only with the weapons of integrity. The only war that can end in peace is the one which virtue wins without force. It is not force that wins, it is integrity. It is not the strength of armament, but the strength of character that is the first line of defense. And while we have not that line of defense, though the weapons that we have will only be used to kill more of each other. It is integrity that must win. And that victory will be a victory of peace and not of strife. We will never be able to battle our way to peace. No matter what we do, the battle will only raise up new enemies, new ghosts, lay new foundations for bitterness and hatred, add up to the continuous effort of mankind to revenge itself from previous difficulties. All this will go on and on. Until we realize that the great victory is the final victory of peace over selfishness, self-centeredness, and personal ambition. When we are willing to do what is right and do what is necessary, we will have that new kingdom, that new heaven and earth, and we will find that we can live together and build together, and something of the eternal childhood of things will come back. Mencius pointed out that the most important thing in the world is the child spirit, and that when the individual gets rid of the child spirit in the process of growing up, he becomes a disillusioned fool, because the child spirit that sees beauty in everything and finds gnomes under toadstools is the spirit which can bring a new birth. And actually, perhaps in the millennium, if it comes, we will all be children again. Children loving and living in a world of brightness and of joy and of friendship. Children with an infinite believing. And also these children in families whose own life is such that we can infinitely believe in them. That there will be no more conflicts, no more stupidity, no more foolishness. And that the way of life as we know it will go, and we will find a childhood that is very beautiful. The childhood of everything being fresh and filled with hope, because we are not the ones who are constantly killing hope. We cannot kill hope and faith and love and have a good world. But if we take care of those things in ourselves, the world will take care of itself and will rejoice exceedingly, and we will have a better destiny than we have ever known or perhaps ever dared to hope for. Most of it simply rests with us, and we're going to have to make these decisions out of our own insights. Well, I guess that's it, folks. And I'd like to make an announcement at this time. For those of you who are interested, I want to announce that Dr. Viola Pettit Neal passed on last Friday afternoon in Arizona. And if you are interested in further information, if your friends of hers are interested in further information on this subject, you may discuss it with Irene Bird in our upstairs lecture room after the present talk. And thank you very much for being with us this morning.